This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
On behalf of my fellow organizers, Constance Penley and Karen Petruska, I just want to welcome all of you to Dirty Sexy Policy. We are so happy to have you here. Thanks for coming. The idea for this conference came from a few different inspirations. I've been trying to convince my students for a long time that policy is not boring at all, and in fact, it's incredibly sexy. It's about money, it's about power, and all of these things that are in other contexts usually extremely exciting, but maybe the hotness that simmers, you know, underneath these issues gets obscured by lawyers or policy nerds like us, or I don't know why, but if this conference was called Dry, Boring Policy, you probably wouldn't be here, although our panelists probably wouldn't care. They'd probably be happy. And I've also had many conversations with Constance Penley, and we realized that despite the fact that we both work with policy issues in our research and teaching, she works on obscenity, and I have written about indecency. She mainly deals with content, and I usually write about the conduits, and our work just really circulates in entirely separate spheres. It's quite striking, really, that content and infrastructure policy are rarely put into dialogue, and we thought that was kind of strange and pretty limiting and just an unnecessary, unnatural divide. So the more we talked about it, the more eager we were to bring these disparate conversations together, and with the expertise of our panelists, who were all happy, I guess, to get out of their winter weather and come to UCSB and the Pollock Theater, and particularly in light of recent developments. In just the past few years, we've had the whole SOPA-PIPA debacle, and it's worth noting that the adult industry was just as roiled as Hollywood over whether it would help combat piracy or stifle innovation. The NSA's PRISM data gathering program, as they called it, Steve Jobs insisting that Apple offers freedom from porn and that those of you who want porn can buy an Android phone. We've had the Supreme Court ruling on the FCC's nearly 10-year-long indecency cases against Fox and ABC, ultimately declaring that the FCC doesn't really have a defined, workable policy about indecency, so that concept is still a vague mystery with boundaries that have yet to be decided. Then last month, we had the D.C. Court of Appeals shooting down net neutrality arguments, or essentially saying the FCC didn't have the authority to regulate the Internet, and they needed to rewrite their own rules and classify the Internet in a way that allows them to actually regulate in the public's interest. We're going to be talking about that tomorrow in panel two. And then we had Comcast announce last week that they were paying $45 billion to acquire Time Warner Cable and create the Standard Oil of cable companies. So this is bad for the public, but very nice timing for our conference. So these events have been really poorly covered, I think, by mainstream media. And in general, reporting on these types of issues almost never addresses the critical junctures that inform and unify content and structural policy debates. Rarely do scholars cultivate these kind of conversations either. Those who concentrate on obscenity and indecency do not typically engage with scholars who are writing or thinking about media infrastructure and broadband policy and vice versa. We hope to bridge some of these divides over the next 24 hours and really speak to the struggles and the stakes that we all share when it comes to concerns over who controls our content, our information, and our access to it. As our keynote tonight, Nicholas Johnson, has written, more important than theories of government, more important than the examples and data you discuss, more important than the personal experiences I could share, more important than all of this is your ability to be thoughtful about the language you use to talk about these public policy issues. So we're using his words as an inspiration for this event as well. We also want to thank the people who have helped to make this happen, this event. The Carsey Wolf Center and its amazing staff, Richard Hutton, Executive Director, Sheila Sullivan, its Associate Director, and the crack team of Natalie Fawcett, Allison Aris, Yongli Lee, Matt Ryan, our theater manager, and his amazing interns, Keith Boynton, who's helping out with our taping of this event, which we will have available to stream on our website, and Isabel Carrasso for her work on the poster. The Media Industries Project, which I co-direct along with the awesome Michael Curtin, has helped finance and this event and has given great support in the form of Michael himself, Kevin Sanson, our research director, and John Vanderhoff, our grad student researcher. Jennifer Hessler has also helped us a lot with the planning of this event, and I want to thank her for her hard work. Tong Nguyen stepped in and did some last-minute tech magic. And, of course, Karen Petruska, who's wandering around in the blue dress and has attended to every single detail of this entire event. Our other generous sponsors, I want to mention the Center for Information Technology and Society, led by Lisa Parks, the College of Letters and Science, the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center, the Rick Rosen Television Studies Fund, the Department of Communication, led by Carsey Wolf co-director Ron Rice, the Feminist Studies Department, and the Film and Media Studies Department, and our fearless leader, Christina Venegas. I want to thank all of them for their support and for helping to bring this event to UCSB. Last but not least, I want to thank our amazing panelists, our two keynoters, and all of you for coming from cold lands far away, for interrupting your busy class and surfing schedules to join us, and to those of you who are really just taking time out and thinking about something new and getting involved in these policy conversations. We have a great lineup for you over the next day. Tonight we have Nicholas Johnson's keynote, which Connie will introduce. Afterwards we have an open reception in the lobby, so please join us for that after the Q&A. Tomorrow we have a keynote in the morning at 9 by the amazing Des Friedman of Goldsmiths, and then three panels, one at 11:15 on indecency and obscenity, one at 2:30 on the politics of infrastructure policy, where we'll be talking about broadband and net neutrality and who controls the pipes, and one at 4:15 that will ideally bring together our earlier two panels and discuss the regulation of content and pipelines in relation to one another. We have ample time for Q&A at all of these panels, and we really hope that you'll participate and take advantage of this opportunity that we have with all these great minds in the theater. So now I want to hand it off to one of the co-organizers of the event, Constance Penley, who will help welcome our keynote. She is the dirtiest and sexiest of all, and she loves a good policy fight, especially if it's indecent or obscene. So please welcome Constance Penley.
Hi, you all. I've never had a more difficult yet more fun task than introducing Nicholas Johnson. Difficult because the resume is so long and varied. Fun because, well, you'll see. Nicholas Johnson is and has been an academic and law professor. He has served as a government official and school board member, public interest advocate, rebel, activist, reformer, writer, lecturer, TV and radio performer, politician, lawyer, and policymaker. I'm not done. Okay. He has formerly, among many other positions, served as co-director of a public health policy institute, network TV host, and congressional candidate. He's the author of many books, most prominently, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set in 1971, and most recently, From D.C. 2012 to Iowa, a collection of postings from his amazing, vibrant blog, which you should read every single day. He's the author of many articles that have been, all of his work gets translated around the world. And he also has a nationally syndicated column, has had a nationally syndicated column. He was an FCC commissioner during the Johnson and Nixon administrations, and a public steward the likes of which we will never see again. I don't give up hope, though. also was the U.S. Maritime Administrator and law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. Nicholas Johnson was the first FCC commissioner to be featured on the cover of Rolling Stone. We hope not the last. But declined the request during his term on the FCC to be a Playgirl centerfold. Are you sorry you did that?
I didn't do it. I turned it down.
Yeah, I know. But are you sorry now that you turned it down? Okay.
Well, no, and you wouldn't be either.
Well, even Playgirl recognized that policy is sexy. Okay. Nicholas Johnson understood the dangers of media consolidation and concentrated power in the hands of those who own the distribution pipes long before it was obvious to anyone else, and spent his career fighting on behalf of the public. As an FCC commissioner, he wrote 400 opinions, most of them dissenting. That's about 400 more opinions than most FCC commissioners ever write. So I can't think of a better way to give you a sense of how wide-ranging his impact has been than to cite some of the brilliant blurbs on the back of How to Talk About Your Television Set. Now, this, by the way, is the 2013 reissue of the 1971 book. I thought I'd like to get an original for him to sign for me, but the cheapest hardcover original is going for $2,420.43. Maybe I can get something better on eBay. I don't know. So here are some of the things that were said about him then. In a business known for its phony glad hand, Johnson's the one person who gets a sincere cold shoulder from the industry. That was the New York Times. Nicholas Johnson is young, bright, and charming. He has single-handedly undertaken to reform U.S. television, a praiseworthy ambition. William F. Buckley. What this good book says is that 40 years of experimenting with private enterprise in the public sector has produced a national humiliation. Fred Friendly, former CBS president. Now, as the back of the book says, the technology may have changed, but many of the problems have only become worse. Fortunately, many of the potential solutions remain the same. Fortunately, too, we have Nicholas Johnson here to remind us of those potential solutions, and we're sure a few more that he's cooked up at this Dirty Sexy Policy Conference. Please join me in welcoming the rock star of media policy, Nicholas Johnson.
Good evening, Santa Barbara. I thank you, Connie, for that introduction. Actually, there's very little I can add to what Jen has explained about what's going on and what Connie has told you about my life. Anyway, I thank Connie for the introduction and Don Novello for that performance. And I want to thank Ms. Carsey for this Carsey Wolf Center. And I think we should take a little time right now. Jen went through that long list of people who made all this possible. But the three people who were sort of preeminent in bringing it about were Connie and Jen and Karen Petrusko. And I also want to give a special thanks to Karen and her colleague John and Matt and Deanna, who's sitting back here in the shadows. Well, you might wonder why I opened with the 5-Minute University. And it is because our hosts have designed such a fulsome, all-inclusive, delightful conference that you're going to need to imagine that Don Novella has loaned me his hat and his cape for what I'm going to do this evening. When I say censorship of indecency, you answer? First Amendment, right? Can you read that there? All right. Now, citizens' rights of entry and access. And you answer? Net neutrality, you're doing very well. Media ownership, and you answer? Diversity. And now, 2 months after the holiday season, when I ask, Who knows if you've been bad or good? You answer? Hey, you got it, you got it, you got it. So now we're coming to themes. And what are the themes that are going to get the Father Guido Sarducci treatment from me? Well, since this is, after all, a Dirty Sexy Policy Conference, a word about media indecency and the role of regulation might be in order. Our hosts have specifically identified the concept of separation of content and conduit, the impact of media ownership on citizens' First Amendment rights is always a concern. The greatest changes since the 1960s have been caused by the technological tsunami that has kind of washed over every institution and individual on planet Earth. Where are we headed? And to borrow from the title of Jonathan Zittrain's book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, what we can do to change course. What are the obstacles in our path? How and why does Washington function as it does? And finally, what are we to do? What is the role of the Academy in directing national communications policy? Although we tried to explain to him that the Supreme Court is not really a part of the executive branch, Lyndon Johnson would occasionally refer to Ma Supreme Court. Well, so permit me to say a few words and have a little fun with my FCC. And why I tried to project where our nation's electronic life was headed. Now, most jobs provide some pretty detailed direction on what it is you're supposed to do. And those of us in the Academy have at least a little more freedom. We know we are supposed to engage in research and scholarly writing and teaching and community service and so forth, but at least we have some opportunity to influence what it is we are going to research and write and teach about. The job of an FCC commissioner did not even involve those loose restraints. Commission meetings were on Wednesdays, and the social norm required that commissioners show up. But actually, Rotary is much more insistent on perfect attendance than the FCC ever was. And a commissioner, of course, should read the staff documents and proposed decisions for the commission, but there was never any exam, and a commissioner didn't have to write anything, and there was no way anyone could measure whether or not any thought had transpired. So the only requirement, really, when it comes down to it, was your ability to raise your hand in order to vote yay or nay on documents that other people had written. Now, I don't want you to be too harsh in your judgments about my fellow commissioners, because, as you know, even members of Congress don't read the bills that they enact into law. And my colleagues did give some thought to their votes. I once whispered to a colleague, I said, "How are you going to vote on this one?" And he turned back to me and he replied, "Well, Nick, some of my friends are for it, and some of my friends are against it. And I'm for my friends." It was kind of like a slogan on a button at a UCLA conference I spoke at about 40 years ago. It declared, "Artificial intelligence is better than none, and certainly voting for one's friends is marginally better than no standard at all." There's the button. Well, the qualifying exam to become an FCC commissioner turned out to be very much like what Peter Cook, who was with that 1960s British group Beyond the Fringe, described as the distinction between the judging exam and the coal miner's exam. Well, aside from the rigor that we went through at a Wednesday meetings, we could write our own job descriptions. One day, Konosuke Matsushita, who was the president of Panasonic, came to Washington and wanted to visit with me. This man, who was born in the 1890s, lived well into his 90s. And this was a time when our corporate executives thought long-range planning was their to-do list for the next 90 days. Matsushita-san, by contrast, had announced a 250-year plan for his company. And I figured if Matsushita-san's long-range planning was measured in centuries, the least the FCC could do would be to have one that was measured in decades. And finding the answer became this commissioner's job description. It began in 1967 with an article in the Saturday Review that urged, among other things, that, quote, the mass media should become common carriers of ideas, a concept I later shortened to the separation of content and conduit, a centerpiece in the current fight over net neutrality's future. My 1967 speculation about our electronics future today talked in terms of potential services and hardware that by the 21st century had come into existence with names such as Amazon, Google, Netflix, TiVo, Skype, online banking, online shopping, time shifting. By 1970, an expanded version of that magazine article was a chapter in the book that Connie mentioned, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. I wrote that we would now have what I then called, quote, instantaneous, ubiquitous, no cost access to all information. Something pretty close to what's now available, at least when compared to the 1960s. What America needed, I decided, was at least one FCC commissioner whose self-described job description would involve going around the country like a modern-day Paul Revere, shouting, "The communications revolution is coming! The communications revolution is coming!" And so that's what I did. Now I'm undertaking a similar 21st century look forward, 30 years or so. The future structure and business plans for democracy's mass media, including how to pay for professional journalists to do local investigative reporting. I knew that what I was doing and the way in which I chose to go about doing it was going to result in the fact that I would never work in Washington again, and I haven't. It seemed to me then and now as a reasonable price to pay. I'd been kind of hard on the agency. At the end of my 7-year term, when the commission finally got rid of me, they literally destroyed all evidence that my office had ever existed. Literally, and shortly thereafter, simply moved everyone out of the building and into a new building. So to provide a little fairness doctrine balance to my remarks, we have former FCC Chief of Staff Zachary Katz here on our second panel. And he will reassure you about our nation's future. Zach will explain how my move and theirs freed the agency from the chains of special interest, enabling it to scale the climbing wall of the public interest and to so rapidly improve that it has now become a model of federal independent regulatory commissions at their very finest. Or not. First, a word about obscenity and indecency. With a first panel that includes a lawyer like Jeff Douglas, the legally savvy Mark Kearns and Daniel Linz, academics such as Peter Alunis and Cynthia Criss, plus the CEO of the Free Speech Coalition, Diane Duke, you certainly don't need any more from me on that subject. But you're about to get a little more anyway. Clerking for Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, as Connie mentioned, during what was the 1959 term of court meant that I was there when he wrote and published both his notable concurring opinion in Smith v. California, which argued that obscenity is protected speech, and his lecture on the Bill of Rights for the very first in the lecture series at New York University, the James Madison Lecture. Now, as you all know, the First Amendment commands, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, which made Justice Black the first Supreme Court justice to ask his colleagues, just what part of no don't you understand? We lost those battles. Governments are free to regulate obscenity, but not indecency, unless it's broadcast. As you may know, this month marks the 10th anniversary of the 9/16ths of a second, $555,000 fine for a Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction. There are, in fact, hundreds of abridgments of free speech. The copyright law, for starters, government-mandated language on a can of food or a cigarette package, prohibitions on revelations of how the CIA and NSA spent our money last week. And, the government even forbids humorous speech. Did you know about that? Have you ever seen that law? You cannot tell a joke while you're going through airport security. It's against the law to have a sense of humor. In my cyber law seminar, we use the acronym EDICT, which stands for Electronics, Digitization, the Internet, Computers, and Telecommunications, to talk about the rapid changes that have come about. And to give you a sense of just how rapid they are, you see before you one illustration of that rapid change. Because it was the end of last year when I played the role of a small town mayor in an Iowa town 100 years ago, and the director thought that the mayor should have a beard, which I grew, and I haven't figured out how to get rid of it. So that was just very recently. Last week, you know what part she had me playing? Playing the part of a talking, texting refrigerator connected to the Internet of Things. I was a refrigerator, and I could talk. And the refrigerator had befriended the homeowner's bathroom scale. And the owner came to the refrigerator, and it was locked. And he was quite upset and was rattling the handle. And the refrigerator said to him, "I'm sorry, Dave, but your bathroom scale says I cannot let you eat anymore now." Some of you got that. These changes also affect the very definition of obscenity. For example, courts say we must apply contemporary community standards. What is the contemporary community standard for obscenity in Santa Barbara or West LA? And once you figure that one out, how about in counties like Nevada and Placer and Shasta and Sutter or Tuolumne? How can you possibly create a California community standard? And after you've done that, try coming up with a global standard in this age of edict. Should the world standard for obscenity and indecency have to respect the standards of all 200 countries? And if not, what do you think the process and standard ought to be? And what are we to make of products like Real Touch that offers couples interactive sex over the internet, complete with the necessary anatomical parts? Is that going to be legally adultery? Now we are coming to the second panel. On infrastructure. And the charge to them is to explore what the conference call expressed as
The new challenges and possibilities for infrastructure policy in light of digital technologies. Follow that? And what a panel our hosts have put together. Harold Feld from Public Knowledge. Zachary Katz, whom I mentioned earlier, is now out at the Annenberg School at USC. Danny Kimball from Wisconsin. Becky Lenz from McGill. Becky is what makes this an international conference. Victor Pickard from Annenberg East at the University of Pennsylvania. And Sharon Strover from America's largest non-glacial state. So we're happy to have them all here. These panelists' insights into our challenges and possibilities, in quotes, will far exceed my own, both in their comments tomorrow and in their past and future writing. And speaking of writing, I especially commend to all of you one of Jennifer Holt's newer books, Empires of Entertainment. The book's subtitle seemingly limits it to the years from 1980 to 1996, for reasons you, those of you familiar with the history will know. But it actually provides a perspective on the entirety of the 20th century, I think, and the evolution to the status quo. Status quo, you know that's Latin for the mess we're in now. And understanding the mess we're in now is really necessary as a prerequisite to exploring the mess we're about to create. America's regulatory compromise between public and private ownership was a product of the radio conferences of the 1920s, called by that great Iowa liberal of the time, then Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover. That is, doesn't anybody remember Herbert Hoover? All right, thank you. An independent regulatory commission would award short-term licenses, make many of the decisions, most of the decisions, that would normally be left to the owner in any other industry, and regulate the licensees against the standard of the public interest, convenience, and necessity. 90 years ago, the miracle of radio was scarcely understood. And yet Congress was sufficiently prescient to anticipate the threats to our democracy that this conference will be addressing tomorrow. Here is how Congressman Luther Johnson of Texas, no relation to Lyndon, no relation to Nicholas, Congressman Luther Johnson of Texas explained it to his colleagues. Publicity is the most powerful weapon that can be wielded in a republic. And when a single selfish group is permitted to dominate these broadcasting stations, then woe be to those who dare to differ with them. Can you imagine seeing that coming 90 years ago? My baptism of fire on these issues was provided by the proposed merger of ABC and ITT, triggering my concerns that ITT might use the network as its public relations and advertising arm for the 400 subsidiaries that it owned. The merger of diverse media companies created additional concerns that we'll be talking about. And they are constantly reconfiguring themselves, like Comcast and Time Warner Cable, something reminiscent of Stephen Colbert's bit about the breakup of AT&T. Well, today there are changes in the cast of characters, the corporations, the industries, the technology, and the sources of the threats to our democracy and the values underlying the First Amendment. But today, it's just the names that have changed. We're dealing with the likes of Amazon and Apple and Facebook and Google and Netflix and Verizon and Comcast. Think when we get talking about Comcast and Time Warner Cable tomorrow, remember this thing is Stephen Colbert's. Congressman Luther Johnson warned us 90 years ago of the challenges we confront today. The actual and potential threat to our freedom to upload and download at a reasonable price. Opportunity for tomorrow's entrepreneurs. More meaningful democratic participation in self-governing. And a better educated population to perform jobs paying more than Scrooge-level minimum wages. Fortunately, we have yet a third panel, which Karen is going to be leading tomorrow. In the late afternoon. They are to give us the answers to, should ISPs be the content police? How can we get more media coverage of our issues? And what alternative media models are there? And how can we bring them about? We're now to the obstacles in our path. When I was trying to build coalitions of media reformers during the 1970s, my universal pitch to everyone was, whatever is your first priority, whether it's improving women's role in our society or saving the whales, your second priority has to be media reform, because without it, you're going nowhere, and with it, you at least have a prayer. And that phrase, your second priority, later became a book title for a sampling of my writing since How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. Since what was then called media reform is already our first priority, I needn't sell you on the idea it should be your second priority, but I have another second priority for you. It is the need to democratize our government and politics and the crucial role of campaign finance reform. Because I believe you and I not only have the opportunity, but the responsibility to take the best of our ideas out of the dusty pages of long-forgotten scholarly journals and put them to work. Josh Silver stands as an example for us. You may know and respect him as I do. Josh was one of us, the co-founder of Free Speech, with its National Conference on Media Reform, some of you may attend. He has now added a second priority, the one I'm urging you to take up. He is now devoting his creative energies to represent us, which he describes as, quote, a movement to end corruption, a modest goal. What follows are some basics about this second priority and what you and I will be up against. Are you familiar with A.J. Liebling's observation that, quote, freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one? Well, the Supreme Court has turned it into constitutional law. Media owners may, as a matter of grace, publish our letter to the editor or allow our call in to a talk show to be broadcast over the air. But we have no legally enforceable right to even buy space in a newspaper or time on radio. Freedom of speech, says the court, includes the power of the owner to censor. The only exceptions were the public access channels that I fought for as a part of the FCC's cable television policy. And I fought for them because of this near universal legal censorship of the mass media. And it is the same reason why today our fight for net neutrality is so important. So there are, of course, those who think abolishing net neutrality is a terrific idea. Second, there is the subgovernment phenomenon. It was not enough that I was a political science major, a law school graduate, an administrative law professor. The belief from childhood persisted. There are three branches of government: legislative, executive, and judicial. So you can imagine my shock to discover that none of those three branches have any power. So where is the power? It is in a place I call the subgovernments. And what are the subgovernments? Well, for those of you who've been to Washington, you may have noticed those old covered wagons you see around town, arranged in circles. Each group of wagons contains the interests that together protect the profit-maximizing interests of their occupants. Virtually every American industry has its own collection of wagons. Here's the way they looked at one point on the mall. We'll limit ourselves to the broadcasting industry's wagons during the 1960s and 70s. So who's in these wagons? One wagon contains an industry's dominant firms called an oligopoly. Many U.S. industries are oligopolies. For broadcasting, this was then ABC, CBS, and NBC, who were, for the most part, perfectly comfortable sharing a wagon. The next wagon houses the industry's trade association for broadcasting, the National Association of Broadcasters. The purpose of trade associations is to utilize the smaller firms in order to lobby in every congressional district on behalf of the economic interests of the oligopoly. There's a wagon for the regulatory agency or commission, originally created to protect the public interest. But as such agencies soon discover, there is far greater security and fellowship within the circle of wagons than outside. And for our purposes, of course, the agency is the Federal Communications Commission. The lawyers who represent the oligopolists and the lesser owners and practice before the FCC have their own bar association and wagon. They call it the Federal Communications Bar Association. In the back of their wagon, maintaining the lawyers' academic credentials, are volumes of their very own law review, the Federal Communications Law Journal. There are lobbyists who specialize in representing media companies, and they too have a wagon. The House and Senate delegate most of their power to committees and subcommittees. The House and Senate Communications Subcommittee members back then had a wagon for themselves and the senior members of their staff. There is a wagon for the trade press, something about as close to media and journalism as most subgovernments ever get. The broadcasting industry's publication was called, quite unimaginatively, Broadcasting Magazine. But it is their symbiotic synergy that reinforces the subgovernment's power. When no one is looking, at night, they come out of their wagons and party. They eat together. They play together. They hold an annual golf tournament. Subgovernments have their own eating club. In this case, of course, the Broadcasters Club. You can't ever tell who is paid for the reception you're attending by who's there, because it's always the same people. They serve the same shrimp. It is so incestuous. They literally intermarry. They switch jobs. They move from one wagon to another. Young lawyers may go first to the FCC and then leave for a job on a communications subcommittee staff, and then finally pick up a job paying more with one of the Federal Communications Bar Association law firms. And once there, they can then go back to the FCC, lunch with former colleagues on behalf of their paying clients. Trade publication reporters may move to the FCC's press office or become a congressperson's speechwriter. Given the subgovernment's power over Congress and the White House, presidents tend to select commissioners from within the industry, such as the current FCC chair, Tom Wheeler. And when their terms expire, or the price is right, former commissioners can stay in the subgovernment, join or even create Federal Communications Bar Association law firms, become executives or lobbyists for communications companies or their trade associations. Although, to be fair, I'm not very fair this evening, but occasionally. Many former commissioners occasionally do contribute to nonprofit and public-spirited projects. Moreover, there are civil servants at the FCC and elsewhere who are bright and ethical and hardworking and idealistic. Unfortunately, even they sometimes find themselves becoming card-carrying members of their subgovernment. Some slowly and unconsciously, others knowingly, deliberately, cynically, mapping their path to more lucrative future employment. Those able to maintain their idealism and independence sometimes find their only meaningful option is to resign or go public. Edward Snowden's assessment may have been wrong. But wrong or right, he appears to be one of those who believe it is futile to pursue whistleblowing through channels. But wait, it gets worse. Because third, there is this dirty little matter of money. How much money? The average amount of money it takes to get elected or re-elected to Congress is nearly $2 million. A Senate seat costs over six times as much, and those are averages. To put Elizabeth Warren in the Senate took over $42 million. Do the simple math. Every day, 365 days a year, in Washington we say, thank goodness it's Friday, only two more working days until Monday. And that's what this is. Every day, 365 days a year, House members need to raise about $2,500 every single day. Senators need to raise about $5,000 every single day for 6 years. And from whom must they beg? America's wealthiest 1%, you think? Not even close. They are phoning from a list of the top 1/20th of 1%, 150,000 individuals, a list you could put in an Excel spreadsheet on your laptop. Obviously, this system has many critics. Some consider it legalized bribery. In fairness, few of the participants are enthusiastic about it either. After all, it is not so much that lobbyists and special interests are voluntarily offering this money to public officials, it is the public officials who demand it of them. In much the same way that outright bribes or protection money is demanded and paid in other contexts, corporate and trade association executives resent those demands. Elected officials feel demeaned by having to make them. It is a form of prostitution, albeit among the fully clothed, at least most of the time. So why does it continue? Because what's called pay to play works for everyone who can afford to pay and who likes to play. The public officials keep their jobs and their perks, and their benefactors are richly rewarded. Both parties get what they want. The only ones for whom it doesn't work, you and me, and others in the 99%. Fourth and finally, what do the donors get? The answer first came to me during President Nixon's administration. The milk producers wanted a higher support price for milk. The Department of Agriculture could find no justification for doing it. The producers gave Nixon $200,000. Shortly thereafter, we all started paying $400 million more for our milk. The math isn't that difficult, regardless of the students' undergraduate majors. $400 million divided by $200,000 is a 2,000-to-1 return on that campaign contribution. 2,000-to-1, that's better than a Wall Street hedge fund. Further research revealed the formula holds for most industries. 1,000-to-1 is a good rule of thumb. You give $1 million, you get back $1 billion. The returns take a variety of forms: subsidies, price supports, tax breaks, tariffs, bargain rates for public lands, favorable antitrust litigation settlements, defense or other government contracts. Sometimes the payment involves the avoidance of a negative, like a CEO who isn't sent to prison, an abandoned antitrust action, or the defeat of tougher anti-pollution standards. Of course, there are other consequences as well. How else can you explain why we are the only industrialized nation without universal single-payer health care? Paying more for our health care while getting less and leaving millions unprotected. Why are we the only nation still using credit cards with magnetic strips instead of embedded chips, subjecting recently 100 million Americans to identity theft. But let's put a face on these other consequences. What does non-regulation, purchased with generous campaign contributions, look like? Here's just one example. A storage facility for the West Fertilizer Company near Waco, Texas, exploded last April 17th. 15 people died, 160 were injured. What does Texas law provide? They don't have to have any liability insurance for hazardous fertilizer storage facilities. Somebody has already taken care of what my late friend Molly Ivins used to refer to as the ledge. What was the last time OSHA inspected the facility? 1985, before some of you students were born. Well, here is non-regulation's mushroom cloud. Here's the fire. Here's some externalities. Here's one victim. Another. Here are non-regulation's coffins and non-regulation's grief. Why is it that when foreign terrorists cause this kind of destruction and human misery, American officials are willing to spend $2 trillion on wars of choice, and yet say and do little or nothing when it's caused by American corporations? Why can't Americans find out the dangers from the 100,000 untested chemicals our corporations are using, two of which recently polluted the water supply in West Virginia? Why has our electric power grid suffered terrorist attacks, risking that we will be left to freeze in the dark? At least in Iowa, you'll still be comfortable here. Why, we ask, why? Because drinkable water and safe workplaces and electric power grid security cost money. Money that will never, during a single 90-day quarter, increase a company's profit or stock price. Cost avoidance is as good as profit, and with a 1,000-to-1 return, campaign contributions are cheaper. And since we privatize profit and socialize losses, much of any losses will be handed off to others, taxpayers, consumers, the injured and dead workers, and the innocents who bear the suffering from our profitable but polluted environment. So what this conference must address are the potential consequences of corrupt, unregulated, phony capitalism for the institutions and issues that we care about, an open internet and a mass media that serves the needs of a democratic society. What are the equivalent consequences for us of the forces that produce polluted water in West Virginia and North Carolina, attacks on the power grid in San Jose, massive explosions in Texas, and hundreds of earthquakes this last month in Oklahoma? Federal and state legislators still shake down the campaign contributors. Major donors get unbelievable returns on their investments. The sub-governments survive and rule. Expenditures on the 2012 elections were something like $6 billion. Now, one of the reformers' favorite proposals is public financing of campaigns through a voluntary checkoff on our tax returns or other means. But what they fail to realize is that we already have public financing of campaigns. If 300 million Americans could pay that $6 billion directly, it'd be roughly $20 a person. By providing campaign contributors the 1,000-to-1 return on investment, we end up paying 1,000 times that much, $6 trillion, or $20,000 a person. We not only pay for it in the form of higher taxes, but also in higher prices for consumer goods and services, automobiles and gasoline, pharmaceuticals and healthcare, insurance and bank rates, cell phone and cable bills, one of which is coming up. It's up to us. Which would you rather do? Would you rather pay $20? You'd rather pay $20,000? You've got your choice. My hope was then that the universities, foundations, and think tanks I visited and implored to do the necessary research and writing, the journalists I briefed on the issues and possible answers, that they would ultimately motivate the public to put enough pressure on the elected and appointed officials to produce action. And that hope remains with me this evening. And you hold the key. The 1967 Saturday Review article with which I began these remarks concluded with words equally applicable this evening. What is required is a brand of imagination that does not flourish in bureaucratic offices, where weekly deadlines leave little time for reflection. The challenge is to make technical advance serve human ends, to define those ends, and mold the techniques accordingly. For this demanding charge, government, for all its expertise, cannot serve the public interest without intelligent public participation. To borrow a familiar campaign line, we are the people we have been looking for. We're the ones, you and I, to whom America must look for the leadership in that intelligent public participation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.